Hello, and welcome to Verge ESP, a podcast about art and science on The Verge. My name is Emily Yoshida. I am the entertainment editor at The Verge.
I'm Liz Lopato. I am the science editor at The Verge.
And I guess I have to start off with a little bit of a plug. We're going to have a few plugs, I guess, if you're into that. Mr. Robot, as some of you may know, premiered this week, the second season did. And it was a double episode. We just got like two robots for our money's worth. But as of next week, if you have not heard, The Verge will be hosting a digital after show. I think the complete title of the show is The Mr. Robot Digital After Show, hosted by The Verge.
Wow, how catchy.
Yeah, it's super catchy. We need a good acronym for it. But it'll be me and Verge Editor-in-Chief Nilay Patel and our security expert, Russell Brandom, all talking about the show, getting at all the weird little tech secrets and Easter eggs and stuff that are inside the show. It should be fun. I'm a fan of this show. I'm very interested to see what direction Sam Esmail takes it this season, just because he's got, I mean, we ran a feature on it by Sean Collins last week, but he's just got insane control over it this season. He's writing and directing and show running the whole thing.
It sounds like an awful lot of work.
Yeah, I mean, to the point where it was really hard to get him, get time with him for the story, just because he's working three jobs. He's literally never not working on the show. And he was on there, they did an after show after the premiere yesterday, so Wednesday, and he did seem a little dazed, like he had been in an editing booth for maybe 36 hours straight. I don't know. I mean, but I think it's cool. I mean, in general, I'm interested in the idea of auteur television. I think you see a little more of that starting to come up on streaming services and on smaller cable channels. But the fact that USA has this show now that's like, you know, if not the highest rated show, certainly one of the most buzzed about shows, like the one that feels very relevant right now, whether you like it or not. And the fact that they're really just like putting all their chips on this guy and his vision for what it should be, which is sometimes very strange, is encouraging. I hope more different people with different kinds of points of view get to do that kind of thing, because it's an interesting long form kind of storytelling that we don't get to see in auteur form that much. So yeah, do you watch Mr. Robot?
I don't. It would, I should, but it sort of interferes with my busy schedule of Murder, She Wrote, so.
Gotta binge them all. Oh, wait, I'm already teasing one of our sections this week, but.
No, I mean, it's a show that I think I would like a lot. I especially like the idea of a tour television as a thing that exists, because I think it leads to weirder shows.
Yeah.
And in general, I love when mediums get weird. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like I think when you have that kind of interest in taking television on as something other than like the sort of like joke committee run thing that like mm-hmm. 30 Rock is about, not that that's a wrong way of doing television or that you can't produce good television that way, just that having like the variety of different types, I think, I don't know, something for everyone.
Yeah for sure.
Speaking of diversity, so the world also likes diversity in general. Or by the world, I mean like nature. There are a whole lot of species out there, you might have noticed. But there's this one invasive species called Homo sapiens that has spread to just about everywhere. And as a result, we have lost so many species, we may actually be putting ourselves at risk. A new study that was published today is Thursday, shows that about half of the land on Earth, the biodiversity, which is like all of the different animals and plants and bacteria and whatever else in your ecosystem, has dropped below a threshold that scientists consider safe. So,
and is that safe as in like, different species won't be able to, just because of the chain of relationships between species, like they just won't be able to continue life as usual?
Well, so, you know, a lot of sort of natural processes rely on sort of a chain of species, right? Like, you know, like you think about like crop pollination, for instance, and like the plants don't do that by themselves.
Yeah.
Or like breaking down dead animals. Like that, again, is not, you know, one species alone. There's a lot of stuff that involves many, many species all working together towards, you know, the common goal of survival. And so one of the possible problems of doing that is that you leave the leftover species a little bit more vulnerable to, for instance, devastating viruses. It's one of the reasons why people argue against like monocrop culture, which is a style of agriculture that is mostly practiced here in the U.S., where you have like large swaths that are just corn or just soybeans or whatever.
Right.
Because that can potentially leave you vulnerable to something affecting that one crop, and then people don't have anything to eat.
Right.
So it can be dangerous in that respect. But also, you know, we don't really know what happens when you remove some of these important species from an ecosystem. Like, it may very well be that the ecosystem collapses. It may alter the ecosystem. We don't know. But
when we're talking not just about like a plant or an animal or something that we think of as being like, you know, something we encounter maybe on a more regular basis, like you're talking about bacteria and microscopic organisms as well, right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, some of these are very specific to certain kinds of plants and animals. So when the plant or animal goes, they go as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, so to quantify the loss, basically, the researchers analyzed more than 2.3 million records of nearly 40,000 species at 18,000 sites around the world. And it looks like on average, you know, the biodiversity has fallen to 84.6% of what it was before humans changed the landscape. And if you account for new species, because we also bring stuff with us, like cats, for instance, the average loss is about 88%. But both of them are below the threshold, which is considered safe by some scientists, which is about 90%. And so that's a little anxiety inducing, because about the local biodiversity has dropped below safe levels across 58% of the land surface. That's like that's more than half of the land.
Is there a plan for fixing this? Or
I'm not sure people yet understand how grave a problem it can be. So yeah. I don't think we've gotten to the point where people are thinking about plans to save anything more than sort of individual species. I mean, like, you know, we have the endangered species list. We have a lot of sort of, you know, haphazard protection acts, but the idea that there should be a variety of species in one place isn't quite captured by that. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So, like, for instance, if we get to a certain number of, like, mountain lions, even if they're all, you know, in the same place, like, they're no longer endangered, even though they may not be part of the ecosystems they used to be a part of.
Right.
So, anyway, conservation is super complicated. Gotta catch them all.
I want to be the best there ever was.
So I have been playing a wild amount of Pokemon Go. I don't know about you, Emily, but I walk a lot, and I now am walking a lot with the Pokemon Go app open.
It's a little, I don't feel like I've seen something become so completely monocultural with the speed that Pokemon Go has. I've been aware, I've been in Los Angeles this week, and I think it was first brought to my attention the night before I left, maybe it was on Thursday or Friday that it came out first, or that it really
Friday.
Started to, like, yeah,
came
no,
out
yeah,
Friday.
Friday. So, yeah, and then by the time I was in L.A., I was like, oh, wait. Oh, I now see every single person on the street in Silver Lake playing it. I'm very interested. It is, like, weirdly banal and addictive in, like, the way that only banal things can be. But it's also very interesting in its implications of the fact that, like, this is what AR looks like in a very broad like popular mass market setting.
And let's also consider for a hot second, like, what a total, like, trash fire the UI is, because, like, there's so much stuff stored in the cloud that if the server for any reason goes down, there's nothing you can do.
Yeah.
But also because so much stuff is stored in the cloud, there's a huge pull on the servers, which means the servers go down a lot. Like, somebody did not think very hard about, like, how this was going to work. And it doesn't matter because
people
just reload the page because it is that powerful, which is something I find a little shocking. Like,
yeah,
usually people get mad if you have a 5-second lag, like, forget, like, constantly throwing you out.
Yeah. I mean, like, It really is the counter argument of just, like, an interface is everything, and that response time thing, and that's going to be what gets people addicted to something, no matter what it is. I mean, I don't know. There are other things that I've been far more resistant to, like Snapchat, that have become much, like, very widely adopted. This, for some reason, even though it is, I would argue, even more, like, opaque than Snapchat, is somehow much more accessible to me. I mean, I just, even though it was broken as shit and completely, and then we'd go down like every 30 minutes. And at first I had no idea what I was doing at all. For some reason, I persevered, and it's not nothing. I don't know what the different, I don't know what the X factor is there, because I'm not a particular Pokemon fanatic. I think they are cute, but it's not like it hits that nostalgia button that I think it does for a lot of people. It's like, oh my God, like this is just what I dreamed about when I was a kid. I could walk around my city and find Pokemon. Like, that doesn't apply to me. I also clearly haven't been swayed by the idea that like all the teens are doing it with other apps. So for some reason, I don't know. I think it's because I don't have to share anything on Pokemon.
I think that's a big part of it. I'm not expected to share anything.
Except for all my data.
Right, of course.
With Niantic.
Woo! No, but you know, so for me, like, I have siblings who are a decade younger than I am. I'm 32. So I missed the initial, like, Pokemon popularity window for myself, but I witnessed it for them. Like, they watched all the cartoons. We had the Game Boy game. I played the Game Boy game. Mm-hmm. And it's just very funny in a way that, like... this is the part, like, I don't know about you, but I'm having this like moment where I just, everything from the 90s has like come back to haunt us. Like,
yeah,
you know, we've got Hillary Clinton running around, we've got Newt Gingrich running around, we've got Pokemon Go, we've got OJ Simpson, who for some reason like is the continuing story of like race in America.
Yeah, it's like the one way we're able to tie everything together or make sense of stuff. It's just like binge on documentaries and fictional, or like not fictional, but like scripted retellings of these stories.
Right. And so I just like, I kind of feel like it's like the return, the attack of the 90s. Like they're back. They're back.
Well, I want to talk a little bit though about like the world that Pokemon suggests, because I was thinking about all the different ways. If I was Niantic and I was like, let's make a big app that everybody can play and search Pokemon and with GPS and in real time, you know, you'll notice that it's a very lonely app. Even if you go and fight other Pokemon in a gym, like the image is of yourself walking around in your cute little hat, like very sporty, sometimes running if you're in a car, never if you're actually running. Just being in this vast, wide plain that just goes forever with the occasional little outposts sparkling in the distance. And this is no matter if you are in the middle of a city, as I was. I spent a lot of time in Koreatown in LA this last week, which was just hopping with Pokemon activity. But even still, like, it was not, looking at the app, it still feels like, oh, I'm in a park.
Like, it's like very zen-like. It's very, very zen-like. I kind of wish there were street names, but
yeah.
Okay.
Well, that's the thing. The other thing is that I would be walking around, and then I'd try to figure out where I should go next, and I would just try to start using the app like Google Maps. And I was like, wait, now I have a whole separate app for that to figure out. Like, there are no street names here. This is not what this app is for. So what if I could just do everything here? What if my avatar could just, like, call and order dinner?
I will say, though, that, like, for all of the loneliness on the screen, my experience has been that, like, when I go to a place and, like, see other people, like, for instance, if somebody has set up a beacon and I go to the place with the beacon and I'm standing there, there are, like, five other people who are also standing there, and you start talking to them.
Yeah.
They'll say stuff like, oh, yeah, you know, like, there's, I don't know, I'm just using an example. There's a Nidorano nearby, or a Nidorian, or whatever that thing is.
Yeah, yeah.
The bunny one. You know, and
bunny.
You end up having these sort of unexpected interactions with total strangers that it, like, gives you a way to talk to strangers that isn't scary or weird or creepy, because you're all doing the same thing. It's kind of like, it's a little bit like a team sport for people who don't like teams.
Right. I mean, I certainly had several of those run-ins for the first few days, and I thought it was pretty fun. I started to notice that it decreased, or there seemed to be, at the same time, I felt like there was a general sentiment that maybe it's like past its prime already. Like, you know, we're moving in internet moments or whatever, and this is already like past. And if you're caught catching Pokemon Go, it's like, oh my God, you're still playing Pokemon Go. Like, I had this vague awareness of it, I think mostly just because of jokes that people were making on Twitter. But then I realized, like, oh, I'm talking to fewer people about it, or I'm seeing it around a little bit less. And then also, if I did see a cluster of people who were playing it, suddenly I would like think twice, because I was like, I don't want to be one of those people. Maybe I'm just like antisocial. But I did, like, for the first few days when it was this weird thing that everybody was figuring out, I certainly was chatting up all sorts of people.
Well, you know, I have no qualms about being a dork in public. I actually am planning on going bar hopping with a couple of friends on Saturday.
No, this is amazing. That's such a good plan. Although it's more bar sitting. You're just like standing watch over your beacon.
Well, yeah, I think that's going to be like the first bar. But like there's like a whole series of bars that are also beacons down the middle of Oakland. And so we're going to start, you know, at one end of that sort of strip of bars and work our way down to the other end. And I imagine it is going to be tremendously fun.
Man. Yeah. I mean, I'm interested to see who tries this next and how, what's the next step, like how they decide to do it when better. I mean, I imagine that fixing the interface and making it not shut down all the time would be one way to fix it.
That seems like a really obvious solution. The other thing that I would say is that, like, gyms aren't very fun because they're like dominated by people who paid a bunch to level up really quickly.
Right.
You know, like I would not mind having a way to, like, when I'm hanging out with my friends, figure out how to fight them. That was part of the Game Boy game, actually, is that you would just run into people and have to fight them. And that was a way to build XP for your Pokemon. And so I would not mind seeing that integrated because I think that would increase socializing a lot.
Yeah. I don't know. In some ways, I do feel like having AR be a part of like a kind of normal activity that's just going around, the people are, that's like in the popular consciousness. In a way, I think over time it'll just be woven into how we understand the rest of the world.
So to me, like, what's compelling about this that is not compelling about VR, because I'm not a big fan of VR, is that it's not as isolating. You know, when you're right. doing VR, you're essentially alone in this world. And I don't just mean like alone in the sense that you're like the only person there. I mean, like, you are like physically alone. Like, when I tried it out, I was in a room full of people. I couldn't see any of them. Like, I could talk to them, but like, it's different.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whereas this, you know, is an overlay on my actual world.
Yeah.
And that's not a terribly new idea. I mean, you see it occurring like even before sort of the emergence of AR as a technology in a variety of like science fiction. But it seems to me to be much more compelling to put the imaginary on the real world
yes.
than to retreat entirely into the imaginary world.
And in a way, I feel like that's in the first sort of wave of people trying to make VR a thing, I feel like a similar sort of block came up that people do at the end of the day want to be in the real world. They, you know, the internet ended up being popularized in the wake of a VR failing or just not catching on because there was a tether to the real world. Even if you're sitting at a screen and loading these pages on like your 36 kbps modem, it's still something where you're walking around. Maybe you're not on the internet. One day you're not surfing the web and you're walking down the street and you're thinking, oh wow, the internet exists right now, like where I am, or in general in the universe, it's here. And as opposed to the idea of having to put on this mask or these goggles or something and go to another place, and that's a distinct reality. And I think especially with how everything is now mobile and social and everything needs to be shareable, and that's just the way, like, how everything is trending, doing something that cuts you off kind of in the similar way to like a movie theater is maybe a little less accessible or less appealing for any kind of duration, any kind of long-term use.
Yeah, I think that's right. Like with a movie, there's like a, you know, tops 3 hours, right?
Right.
That you're sitting in a theater. And even then you're not really like totally alone, even if you're unless you're like watching on Netflix, I guess.
Yeah.
But like still, like it's you understand the reason for the isolation in a way, because it's meant to make you focus on this thing that actually exists in the real world that is an imaginary thing from somebody's brain.
Yeah.
But the real world is still there, obviously. Like, there's, like, the person next to you in the theater who's eating popcorn too loudly or whatever. Like, it's not like you're wholly isolated. And, like, the thing about the internet that I think people like to forget when they talk about like how it's making us disconnected is that like a lot of the internet, like a really big part of it is people trying to connect with each other IRL. Like that's the right. whole point of internet dating and like yeah. any of a variety of other like interest groups. Like there are meetups, you know?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
People might socialize online because it is a convenient way to socialize, but given the opportunity, they typically want to meet one another.
Yeah. Yeah. And you see that now, you know, with the Pokemon thing, not just running into people, but people actually like organizing around it and finding ways to use it to find, I guess, fellow Pokemon enthusiasts. I don't know what the tribe is necessarily, because it's just like, it's everybody right now. It's just like, it's literally everybody. There's no, all you have to do, I guess I should be specific. It's people who have a cell phone and can afford a LTE plan. That's who's using it. But,
and have external batteries because holy cats,
oh,
is that
yeah.
terrible on your bad battery
yeah,
life.
Yeah, it's bad. That's like the only thing that keeps me from being on it more. Yeah, I don't know. I'm not opposed to it. I'm more interested to see how it pans. It has the feeling of being like this new thing in an imperfect form that will eventually be a part of our daily experience in some way or another, whether that's through advertising or some other less, I guess, exploitative purpose. We'll see. But it does feel like having this sort of real-time interactive layer over the world feels like something that's just going to be, it's just there to be molded for whatever purpose we decide.
I think there are so many possible creative ways of engaging with that as well. Like, not just for games, but as ways of storytelling or entertainment.
Yeah. Have you heard of this thing? I feel like people who, it might be like a Radiolab involved thing. I'm going to totally forget the name of it. But they've done it a couple years, I think, at South by Southwest, where it's an audio tour and you walk around a city and it's sort of a story that's being told. It's not just like an audio tour of like this building was built in so and so. Yeah, but like it'll show you like little secret passages and stuff that you can go in and like seek, like just little things to discover it, but it'll just be this voice in your headphones that's telling you where to go. And I think it's interactive. I think it's GPS sensitive. I think it knows where you are and cues up different prompts depending on where you are, which is kind of cool.
Well, I mean, Pokemon Go, as far as I can tell, is basically just a skinned version of the previous Niantic game, which is Ingress.
Right.
And right now, like, a lot of the Pokestops reflect that. They're just, like, points that, like, Ingress players, like, thought were interesting. And so, like, in Oakland, for instance, a lot of them are trash cans. Because there are, this is not a joke, there are mosaics, like, very beautiful mosaics on the Oakland trash cans, especially downtown, if you look. And so, like, all of those trash cans have been noted in the app. And it's, like, this very funny, like, I guess that's part of what appeals to me and why I'm a little sad to hear that they're already, like, exploring ways with businesses. I mean, of course they are, to you know, pay to be a Pokestop. Because, like, right now part of the fun for me is that it's just, like, whatever some random group of people thought was interesting.
Yeah. Or just and murals.
Like, yeah.
So much of it is public art or churches.
Yes.
Which is just like the opposite of what like a Yelp app, for example, if a Yelp AR app would just like point out restaurants or something that were cool or like you were supposed to visit or something. But like something that's just something that you would never notice otherwise.
Well, in some cases, it's like things that I've walked by every single day that I haven't particularly noticed.
Yeah,
and then
yeah.
like, you know, playing Pokemon Go, there's like a thing there and I'm like, what the heck? And then, yeah, sure enough.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I don't know. I haven't played it much in New York. I've mostly just been in LA with it. So I have to see what kinds of wild Pokemon we have around the office. I think I've heard there's a lot of Zubats, so...
That doesn't surprise me.
It's just New York. The best thing is when I got home last night from the airport and I was back in New York and I opened it up briefly just to see what was around. And, you know, it shows you what Pokemon are in the general vicinity that you might run into. And all there was were two Rattatas, like two rats. And I'm like, tell me something I don't know. But...
I had an exciting experience. For those of you who live in the Bay Area, there is a really beefy Magmar next to the Lake Merritt boat station. It's like 800. It'll show up as like CP ?? So that was pretty cool. I was excited about that.
Well, I guess tell us where there are rare Pokemon to be found in either Brooklyn or San Francisco, and we'll
be
on
it. Yeah, man, help us level up. We need to get some gyms.
So I published a story yesterday, if you're listening to this on Friday when this pod goes up, called, and all credit to our features editor, Michael Zelenko, for this headline, Eat, Pay, Love. And I basically spent the last few months reporting on, interviewing, and talking to users of this app called Olala, which it bills itself as a instant paid dating app. Its creator, Pia Poppenreiter, describes it as a dating app first and foremost, but in it, men pay women for dates. They pick a time and a duration and a ballpark cost. And then presumably two people are able to meet up and make money, or at least one person's able to make money. It's been called the Uber for escorts because everything needs a pithy name, and I feel like that's just how like apps get referred to now.
Yeah, the Uber for this or the Uber for that. Yeah.
Or the Airbnb for blank or and I think in general they don't like to use the word escort, and especially now that they've come to New York, it's very dicey for legal reasons, obviously, even though being an escort is typically, it exists in a legal loophole in the United States. But it was very interesting, though, to just sort of talk to this woman who's, you know, our age. She lives in Berlin, Pia, and she is very interested in redefining, I guess, or like resetting our notions of what a paid date is and what kind of person goes on a paid date and gets paid for a date. So I don't know. It was a very interesting subject for me to report for a while, but I still felt like even at 5,000 words or however long it is, that there was still so much I wish I could have talked about.
So let me ask you a question, because I read the article, and it seems like the argument she's making is that women should be paid for going out on dates because dates are serious emotional labor. Is that a good nutshell summary of it?
Well, that's my understanding of it. I don't think that she has ever said that to me exactly. She more refers to, and so does Brandon Wade, who's the founder of Seeking Arrangement, refers more to the material costs of that a woman has for being date ready. That doesn't just mean cab to get to see your date or a dress to wear or makeup, but just the continual, it's like a, you know, for certain women who want to look a certain way to be attracted to a certain kind of man, and I'm not saying like, I'm not, this means nothing, like I'm not like labeling that in any way, but like it takes an investment. Like if you feel like you need to be in a certain kind of physical shape to get a date, then you should probably have a gym membership and be able to pay for, like, I don't know, expensive nutritional supplements or whatever you feel like will make you an eligible human specimen. And, you know, it's definitely more of a monetary investment over time for women than for men in general on average. But it's just, I think the emotional part is more what I observed in talking to a user of the app. Because it is very much this thing of I'm being paid, maybe not being paid to sleep with somebody, but being paid to show up and be pleasant and engaging and laugh at somebody's jokes and do all that stuff, which I feel like all falls under the category of emotional labor.
Yeah, absolutely.
If people aren't familiar with that term, then that's, yeah.
It's emotional labor is basically the stuff that holds us together, that glues us together, the relationship stuff. And like, for me personally, like one of my hesitance for using in something like this, as I was reading this, is that you agree for a time and an amount of money. And one of the things that I value most about my personal approach to dating, which I don't expect anybody else to necessarily follow, but like, if I'm on a bad date and I'm not enjoying myself, I can just leave.
Yes. Yeah.
I can literally just get up and leave. I've done it before. I've done it mid-beer. yeah.
It's not even worth the rest of the beer. That's when you know.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's a point at which you have someone explain to your job to you so thoroughly that you're just like, well, I don't know why I'm here since you only want to talk to yourself.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I think there is a little bit of a contract that's a little bit murky. The user that I talked to talks about that also in terms of like going for a second date. Like if you get along with somebody and they paid you a certain amount the first time, what do they pay you the next time? Is that the way that your relationships exist, or do you stop paying because now you've just found each other and you like each other and you paid for the opportunity to meet each other? It's I think what makes people uncomfortable is when you, I think a certain kind of liberal person is comfortable with the idea of women being escorts. I mean, men and women being escorts, and that being something that goes on. I think when you start to blend that with dating, I think that's what people have a harder time with.
Yeah, except, and as you point out in your article, money has always been blended with dating.
Yes.
Like, one of the biggest points of contention is, like, who pays, right?
Yes.
Like, I know that there are other people who do this differently, but I typically pay for a first date if I like the guy, because it's a really good litmus test of whether or not he's comfortable with me being bossy. Because the fact of the matter is, I'm going to be bossy occasionally, and, like, if you have a hard time with that, it's not going to work.
Yeah. Huh. That's a good trick. I mean, yeah, it's always been... I mean, that comes up on a Tinder date. You know, you go out for a drink with somebody, and at the end of it, if a guy pays for your drink, it's like, well, what does that mean about this encounter? It's maybe not
right.
As large as if it's like you're PayPaling somebody $600 at the end of a night, but...
I've definitely run into guys who bought me a drink and thought that entitled them to sleep with me because they had purchased me for the price of a drink.
Right.
Like, you know what I mean?
I think just about
everybody has. This is a common attitude.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I don't think that's unusual at all. I mean,
that's the game we're playing,
yeah.
Then, like, yes, pay me $600 then.
Well, that's the funny thing is that in while I've been working on this and talking to it just in conversation with people, and now having seen people's reactions to it, without fail, men have much more of a problem with it, or are much more uncomfortable with this idea than women, because I think women, especially if you've had a lot of bad dates in your life, or you just have been around people who think that that's the way that they can, you know, rent you in a certain way,
yep.
Even if it's not under those auspices, they know that this isn't that different in a way.
It's not.
I think the thing to me that I ultimately, because I've been like thinking about this for 2 months, and I've just been like, what do I have to say about this? Like, what do I actually feel about this? I think ultimately what is unfortunate to me about it is if you are trying to say this is just a dating app, and this is like for a girl who maybe isn't a full-time sex worker or escort, but it's a way for her to pick up some extra cash. It's just another thing that's another money-making activity that's colonized what used to be free time. And I think that's the real loss, is that, yeah, it's very easy to be cynical about dating and just like the transaction that exists even without a real transaction. When you actually start pursuing it as such, though, it's like, I feel like over time, and I feel like it's different for people, it's different for everybody, but I do feel like it's that thing of... You know, you hear about people doing task rabbit jobs, and they're, you know, I have a spare 30 minutes between, like, my lunch hour. I'm going to go, I don't know, alphabetize something for somebody. It's just like every single minute can be blocked up with billable hours. And that feels a little bit exhausting for me to think about.
Yeah, I guess my counterpoint is, like, I don't know if you're that familiar with the Give Your Money to Women movement. It was... Bardo Smith, Yoshin Lords, and Lauren Chief Elk Youngbear kind of came up with it last year, and it was like a hashtag on Twitter and like sort of something that has been filtering around in the culture for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
But it is the idea that women should be paid for the emotional labor that we do if we have people who are, if we're encountering people, mostly men, who are unwilling to do it. And there is something there, like, I totally understand your concern about, like, why should every moment of your time be monetized? That's fair. But I also... find that, like, if I am expected to do a lot of the emotional labor and to be always smiling and laughing at your jokes, and you aren't going to smile and laugh at mine, then maybe you should fucking pay me. You know, like, I'm putting in work here. And if you're not going to put in work, yeah. then, like, what the fuck are we doing?
Yeah. And I think a lot of women do this without even thinking about it as labor. I think just being able to recognize it as a kind of work and as a kind of glue that holds together interactions and holds together, you know, an evening or a dinner, like whether you're just one-on-one with somebody or with a group of friends, like being able to smile and laugh and say, uh-huh, like that's tiring. And I speak as a person who is like a real just like diagnosable introvert where interactions with other people do actually exhaust me. Like it's some people get energy from that. Some people don't. I am one of the people who don't. And so especially being in a first date scenario when I have been, especially in something like Tinder, where it's a genuine stranger, you don't have anything to go off of really. That's a big ask. Like that's a very big like, hi, I'm going to be my best self for 4 hours and try to be as attractive to you as possible and like try to, you know, make sure that this isn't awkward or something, you know, doing all those little, I don't even know what you call them. It's like micro interactions or something.
Yeah, all these things you do to make other people feel comfortable.
Yeah.
And like that's like, you know, that's larger scale than just dating, right? It's
yeah.
like sending,
yeah,
sending anything. Birthday cards, like
sending
keeping
an
track
email.
Of people's birthdays, like shit like that.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I talked about this book on this podcast, but I reference it also in the article called Labor of Love. And one of the things that's so interesting to me about it on the point of emotional labor is that she talks about how basically women became pursuers of men as soon as basically after we stopped calling on people. Like women were out either working in offices alongside men or working in environments where they would meet men, whether they were shop girls or like working at a restaurant or something, the work has been actually more on the woman to be interesting and attractive for a man so that he, when he approaches her, he can feel as though it was his choice. You know, like he can still feel like the idea of a man as a pursuer and a woman as the pursued, that still is intact when in fact it's not at all. And I just thought that was so interesting because not only do you have to pursue, but you have to make it look as though
you're not pursuing
and you're not being aggressive and you're just there as this passive thing to be desired or sought after. And it's just so... it's really interesting when you think about it. And I don't think that any of this applies to like all relationships, all male-female relationships even by far. But I do think on a like a broad traditional and Western understanding, that is like kind of how we've set up the idea of dating. And I don't think that stuff like Tinder or Bumble and all these things that supposedly end dating actually are doing that at all. They're just like changing the definition of a date.
I mean, this is again, like, this is why I have a hard litmus test of will a guy let me pay for him?
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? Like the whole idea that like men can't be pursued, like there's like a whole raft of ideas that go along with that.
Yeah.
Like that are, let's say I don't like them.
Yeah.
I find them in many ways hurtful and exhausting. And like, you know, one way or another, that's like sort of the landscape we have to navigate around. Like you can choose to like buck the system and show up to, you know, the date in like your jeans and like a dirty AC/DC t-shirt and like, you know, do that. Or you can dress up really nice and potentially get some guy who just treats you like a jerk. Like, that's, like, a lot of it is out of your control. And
or
like,
you could dress up really nice and have a nice guy treat you nicely.
I mean, that happens too, but that's a lot more rare, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it kind of depends on what you put out there, right? Like, I think a lot of time, and it's a weird kind of feedback loop where... you know, when I used to look at Tinder and I would see guys on there that I knew, like, intellectually were attractive, but I also knew that just from little signifiers, I was like, that guy does not treat women well. Like,
yep.
You can just see it. Like, it's just, like, little things where it's like...
no drama?
Yeah.
That is, like, a dead giveaway. That's,
oh,
that
yeah.
says, I am a drama queen and I will make your life miserable.
No crazies, no drama. Yeah. I don't know. It's been very interesting to see people's reactions to this piece, mostly because I've just been in it for so long that I've forgotten that to some people, it's still kind of a shocking concept. And so I'm like, by the time I'm hitting publish, I'm like, oh my God, I'm so sick of thinking about this. Yeah, a little lot, paid dates, whatever. And then it goes up and everyone's like, oh my God, this app. And like, yeah, yeah, that's actually like what I've been talking to people about for the past several months. And it's nice to see reactions, both positive and negative, just because I think it dredges up a lot of stuff that's usually left silent. Just the existence of this app does, which I think is interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I was surprised that like so many of the commenters were like really focused on determining whether or not a woman who uses this app is an escort,
yeah,
and not thinking about the sort of bigger picture part of it.
Yeah, it's like, that's the end. Like, if you can figure out if she's an escort, then you've solved it and we can move on.
But like, what have you solved? Like, that's the question.
You figured out a word that you could be comfortable categorizing a person as, and I just feel like more and more that's not going to be. I don't even know that this app is going to be widely used or super popular, but I think those lines of what's economic and what's emotional are going to blur more and more as time goes on.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, it's one of those things where, like, I think given a lot of the discourse around emotional labor, and if you're not familiar, there is a lot, I would not be surprised to find that there is going to be a significant amount of women demanding that stuff that's unpaid that they're supposed to do, we're supposed to do because we're supposed to find it fulfilling, that in fact is a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
It would not surprise me at all for women to start demanding monetary compensation for it, if only to get it to the same kind of standing as paid work, to
right,
get it considered seriously in the same way.
Right. Yeah, there's two ways you can go with it. I mean, one commenter had the interesting insight that by trying to say like, oh, this is for normal people, like this, a normal person can get paid for a date too, that you're kind of stigmatizing sex work and escorts even more. But I think there's two ways you could go with it, because you could just normalize it so much that, like, I don't know. It's hard to imagine that, especially in the United States, where things are still very, very deeply conservative when it comes to sex work. But
Puritan, one might
Puritan,
even say.
Puritan, yeah. So, yeah, I think time will tell. But in the meantime, it's been really interesting talking to people about this.
Yeah, I bet. Did you have any like really good anecdotes that you wanted to put in the story but that got cut for length? I'm very curious now.
Oh, man. I mean, I spent a lot of time trying to talk to guys on the app, and most of it was not fruitful. The interesting thing is that most guys are saying, yeah, all the women here are like working girls, but that's not what I'm looking for. I'm looking for a real girl. And then, you know, talking to women on the app, they're like, yeah, I think there must be a lot of escorts here because guys always treat me like I'm an escort. So it's like, you know, there's an invisible fleet of escorts and people looking for them on this app that nobody is willing to cop to. And, you know, this kind of thing is very hard to interview people about, just because.
Yeah. I want to parse out something. So they're on an app,
mm-hmm,
where they pay to date.
Mm-hmm.
Right. These guys.
Mm-hmm.
And they are surprised to find escorts there, and they want to find a real girl, but they are still on an app where they pay to date. Am I following this correctly?
Yeah. I wouldn't say they were surprised. I wouldn't say that's the tone of it, but I think that they're maybe a little bit frustrated. That's how I would characterize these conversations. And you know, I was like, I don't know what to tell you. Like, I feel like there's something I'm forgetting, though, that was a good... This is mostly about Brandon Wade, who created Seeking Arrangement. But in an interview, you know, I don't have this in there, but Seeking Arrangement is probably the most famous sugar dating app, and it's like the one that Anthony Weiner got busted on for messaging women on. And there was also a big scandal that happened when I think a Google VP overdosed on heroin with a woman that he met on Seeking Arrangement. And the story came out, and, you know, there was all this, you know, hubbub again about this app and the idea of sugar dating in general, and the CEO just being like, just completely blankly, like, yeah, that was great for us. Like, that was fantastic publicity for us.
Wow.
Yeah. So, because, you know, that way people knew that people who worked at Google were using Seeking Arrangement. So, you know, I think that there are good... good actors and bad actors in this, and that's all that I will say about that. But yeah, we should probably wrap it up right now. But thank you all for listening. We're going to be off for the next couple of weeks and back, I guess at the beginning of August. Is that right?
I think that's right.
We've got a bunch of stuff going on between Panorama, which you should definitely come out and check out if you're in the New York area, the Panorama Music Fest. And as I mentioned, the Mr. Robot digital after show presented by The Verge, which will be airing on USA's website and on the Mr. Robot Facebook page, I think, after each episode airs this season. So check it out.
Cool.
Do you have anything else to plug?
Well, you know, if you're around at 12:45 a.m. on Monday Eastern time, which is a normal hour where I am, that's 9:45 at night. I suggest checking in with The Verge to watch a rocket launch and possibly land.
Oh yeah. That's going to be cool. Who's going out for that? Who's going to be there?
Lauren and Miriam are going to be there. They're making video. That's you know, not going to be right on the site immediately.
Right.
But there will be a skeleton crew of us hanging out and doing our usual rocket launch thing. I will probably do my thing with deranged GIFs.
Cool.
So, you know, I love rocket launches. I love the way that people interact around them. It's like maybe one of my favorite parts of Twitter is space Twitter. So please feel free to join us. It should be fun.
Cool. So in the meantime, you can tweet at us. I am at Emily Yoshida and Liz is at MS Lopato. And you can subscribe to us on Spotify on your phone or on iTunes. And also on SoundCloud, you can follow us. And is there anything else? No, I think that's it. Those are all the ways you can reach us. So we'll be off for 2 weeks, as I said, but we'll be back in August, ready for more Verge ESP.
Good luck catching your beefy Pokemon out there, guys.
Bye.